Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. Also, go over to the YouTube channel. We got a new series that is dropping every week about postmodernism. It's actually called Questions on Culture and Belief, and that is with Scott Keith, Bruce Hillman, and myself. And we're asking interesting questions like, are all beliefs equal, or what is certainty, that sort of stuff. We drop one of those videos every week. They're usually about 40 minutes long or so. I know that you can handle 40 minutes of content because you listen to this podcast. So go over to the YouTube channel if you haven't done it before. You know, subscribe to it, ring that bell so you don't miss the content that's going on there. Chad drops a video on there every week as well. Maybe you're one of those people that's like, I'm not doing this social media thing anymore. Maybe you're taking a good look at the world and you're like, you know what? I don't think this social media is helping me. Now, guys like Chad and I, we don't have any choice. We have to be on social media. It's part of our job. But if I didn't have to be, I probably wouldn't be. So I understand it. But maybe you just listen to this podcast. Well, you can go to YouTube and be real selective with the things that you get, the stuff you get. And you might not know that Chad's dropping videos because you're not on social media and you're just listening to this podcast. So, you know, if you're just a podcast listener, but you don't want to do the social media thing, at least you could do YouTube and get some more content. But if you are a social media user, I don't think I've ever done this, Chad. You could follow Chad or I on social media because we are on there, in case you were wondering. Yeah, so you can look us up on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, all that, all those things. We're doing all those
things. TikTok.
I'm not on TikTok.
I'm not on TikTok either.
Yeah, you could probably follow my wife on TikTok. I think she's on there. I'm not doing the TikTok. I'm not on the Snapchat. I'm not on those. The big three: Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. You can follow Chad and I over there, or Crystal Fast, or 1517. All right, Chad. We're like smack dab in the middle of the second chapter of Ruth. Ruth and Boaz have met, and Boaz has given her some good news, told her that she doesn't need to go glean anywhere else. She should just stay right there.
Yeah, they started off on the right foot, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you got to wonder, is Boaz just like the nicest guy ever, or is he also a little interested right from the jump?
Yeah, I have a feeling that there's a little bit of mixed motivations here.
Yeah.
I'm sure he is a very nice guy. I mean, nothing in this book, but that's what's so weird about this when you think about this actually set in the period of the judges, because, you know, you're going through judges, you're like, are there any decent people left? Like, I mean, just, I'm not talking about like super righteous people. I'm just like decent, nice people. Because you finish judges, you're like, I don't know, man, maybe there's not. And you get to Ruth and it's like, wow, you know, like you leave this deep, dark cave full of these vampire bats. And then you walk out into this bright sunlight. It's like, wow, this is nice. And that's kind of what, that's the impression you get of Naomi and of Ruth and of Boaz. These are just, you know, these kind of people you wouldn't mind being your neighbor.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're right next to you. Yeah. Boaz help you out with some yard work, help you fix your car, like do whatever you need. That's a Boaz kind of person. But yeah, when they met, he right away he noticed her and he made sure nobody was gonna bother her. And not only that, but I mean he's gonna go on, as we'll see now, and he's going to make sure that she never goes hungry. So some pretty cool stuff coming up here. I think we'll probably have two, this one and another one, or this one and two more episodes, and we'll get our way all the way through Ruth. So got some good stuff coming up. So yeah, we left off in chapter 2, around verse 13, I believe, something like that. And verse 13 is when Ruth responds to all this good stuff, this love, this mercy that Boaz has shown to her. And she says, I have found favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and indeed have spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not like one of your maidservants. It's interesting there because I bring it up now because it's become significant later on. As you go through the book, there's a gradual progression of the names and titles which are either applied to Ruth or which she applies to herself. So when we meet her, she's a wife, and then she's a widow, And now she identifies herself as a shivcha, which is, in Hebrew, is basically the lowest rank of servant. So there's, you know, there's different kinds of servants in the ancient world. And at this point, Ruth identifies herself as the lowest of servants. And as we'll see when we get into chapter 3, she's going to raise herself up a little bit more in the way she designates herself. And there's a gradual progression as we go along. Anyway, here's what happens next. Verse 14 of chapter 2. At mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come here, that you may eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread, dip your morsel in the, well, something." You can translate that wine. You can translate it vinegar. You can translate it wine vinegar. There's various ways to translate that. We'll come back to that in a second. So what'd she do? Well, she sat beside the reapers and he served her. Boaz served her roasted grain and she ate and was satisfied and had some left. Let's pause there for a second. I mean, he's already done a lot and now he's like doing even more. He's like, this is kind of getting back to what you said earlier. It makes you just wonder. I mean, is he just like a one of these guys who is just a super nice, neighborly sort of man who's willing to help out the disenfranchised, the hungry?
Or is he doing this?
Something else going on here?
Is he doing this all day, every day with everybody?
Anybody shows up in his field gleaning.
Come on now, man. I don't feel like he's doing this with just every person.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
this is all he does all the time. Like, he doesn't do anything else.
Yeah, so I mean, he's going above and beyond here. You know, he's inviting her. Yeah, come sit with us. Be part of the group. You know, he basically invites her to have a seat at the table and to eat of this roasted grain, which I suppose was a pretty typical meal that they would be eating, and to dip her bread in the chometz is the Hebrew there. And I did a little research on that. It's kind of hard to pin down exactly what it is. So it probably is possibly alcoholic in some way, because if you go back and you read the rules about Nazarites, you know, there's lots of things they can't consume. They can't consume any alcoholic beverages. And this is listed among some of the things that they can't consume. But then elsewhere, it's used in reference to something that's sort of a sour, like a sour wine, a sour drink, something like that. Something to kind of make you, I don't know, pucker your lips or something like that. Now, this is another kind of fascinating, I don't want to get too far down this rabbit hole, but so if you look in Psalm 69, verse 21, I'm just quoting this from memory. I think this is right. They gave me gall for my food, and for my thirst, they gave me vinegar or sour wine to drink. I believe that's where that verse goes. Now, that's the Hebrew word, right? That sour wine or wine vinegar. Now, here's the fascinating part. I looked at that in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation. And the Greek translates that Hebrew word as oxos, which is the exact word that's used to describe the liquid that the soldiers gave to Jesus to drink on the cross in Matthew 27:48. So it's kind of a, when you start kind of putting these together, it's a pretty fascinating trail to follow. So what is this? I mean, some people suggest it's like a condiment. You know, like you go to, I don't know, you go to some restaurant and they bring you out a loaf of bread and you know, you can dip it in the olive oil or something. Some people say it's that. Some people, you know, it's alcoholic drink. Whatever it is, anyway, when you kind of trace its orbit through the rest of the scriptures, it ends up at the lips of Jesus on the cross.
Yeah,
so it's a pretty cool connection there.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense that, contrary to what a lot of people would like you to believe, loads of things were a little bit alcoholic back in the day, mm-hmm. because served as a way to preserve them and to keep them from spoiling, because so it wouldn't be surprising if you took like some wine and then you mixed vinegar with it and you were kind of making this whatever, even if it was a condiment kind of thing. Degrees of alcohol serves for a purpose, and then there's no refrigeration, man.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Alcohol was not simply a way to go make merry, but it was also a way to have things not go bad on you.
Yeah, alcohol was used just all over the world back then. You know, you had I think we've mentioned this before. When you look back at some of these old lists that are in cuneiform that describe like what workers were paid, a lot of times in those lists it will not only describe the food they're given, but also the alcohol they're given. This bricklayers, well, they get a pint of beer a day and a couple pounds of grain or whatever it might be. So the drinking of wine and beer and other kinds of alcoholic beverages was just widespread in the ancient world. And like you say, it's not like you can put stuff in the fridge.
Right.
It didn't work that way. That's why I was kind of chuckle when people describe Jesus possibly using grape juice at Passover. That'd be pretty hard to do because there would be no grapes to get juice from that time of year. And you can't make grape juice without it. You can't get the juice of grapes without it beginning to ferment without refrigeration.
So. Or pasteurization. You gotta have one of the other, you gotta have something. Like you have to have a modern process to keep it from becoming alcohol. Things become alcohol if you don't have a way to prevent it. Like that's a natural way of juices.
Yeah, yeah.
Anything with sugar in it, man.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's pretty cool when you look at what he's doing here. This is what's going through my mind here. So he's reaching out to someone who, has no protector, someone who is not just an Israelite widow, but she's a widow that is from, a foreign country. She doesn't belong. She's not part of this community. And so he's reaching out to her. He's taking care of her. He's inviting her to the table and he's serving her. It's kind of the word that's used there for serve is only used in this one particular place in the Old Testament, which is probably like highlighting his action that he, the field owner, he's not just serving like one of his workers. He's serving someone who's poor and defenseless and is out there just gleaning the field. So he's really going all out to take care of her. And when you look at where Ruth fits into the broader message of the scriptures, where he is a redeemer, he's one who cares for those who can't care for themselves. And you see him as a Christ figure. My mind cannot help but make the leap to exactly what Christ does for us. I mean, he reaches out to us. He welcomes us to his table. He feeds us. He serves us. And I think we don't really usually like talk about this explicitly, but as far as like biblical interpretation goes, I think that's the way you do it. I mean, am I saying, oh, well, this verse is about the Lord's Supper? Well, no. But when you look at this in the big perspective of the total message of Scripture, it fits within this pattern of God himself or God through others inviting people to the table and serving them and providing for their needs. So is it about the Lord's Supper? No, but yes. When you look at the complete message of the scriptures, this is exemplary of how God deals with us as his people.
Yeah, I mean, this verse might not be about the Lord's Supper, but the Lord's Supper is a little bit about this verse.
Yeah, there you go.
It's included, right? This is a good picture of what Christ is doing at the Lord's Supper, among other things, of course, forgiving sins and all this other stuff.
Yeah, but sure.
But there is this, the greater serving the lesser. The verse itself might not be about the Lord's Supper, but what the Lord's Supper gives us is certainly pictured in this passage.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. All right, well, we covered one verse. I guess we better get to moving.
Yeah.
All right, so what happens? Well, she ate, had some leftover. And when she rose to glean, so she kind of leaves, she's going back to what she came out there to do. Boaz passes on this message to his servants. He says, let her glean, even among the sheaves, do not insult her. So he's going to reiterate the fact that they're supposed to not in any way say or do something to her, which might drive her away. And he adds this, I love this. He says, also, you shall purposely pull out for her some grain from the bundles and leave it that she may glean, and do not rebuke her.
Telling them to get a little sloppy with their gathering.
Yeah, like pull out bunches of the grain that you're gathering and just drop it there for her to pick up. So, and we evidently they certainly followed his instructions, because the next verse tells us that she gleaned in the field until evening, and then she beat out what she had gleaned. So she found a little place. Maybe she went to the threshing floor. Wherever she went, she beat it out, and it came out to a measurement called an ephah or an ephah of barley. Now that's kind of easy to just kind of go over your head, because that's not the kind of measurement that we use. You know, we're like, oh, okay, so she got an ephah of barley. Well, it turns out when you look at the way that this measurement was used in other biblical places, and we know from some archaeological sites approximately how much this was, there's some differences of opinion. But we know from Ezekiel, for instance, that an ephah, which is the unit for dry measurement, things like, you know, grain, and that it's equal to a bath or a bat, which is a liquid measurement. So Ezekiel tells us that. And archaeologists have found some pottery, and they can tell from the size of the pottery how much it was, and it has like one bath on there, or two baths, or however much it is. So we have a pretty good guess, in other words, how much an ephah was. And it was probably anywhere from, get this, 30 to 50 pounds. can you imagine? You know, you're gleaning. I mean, you're probably doing good to get a pound to 2 pounds of grain on a typical day. And we also know, speaking of that, from other lists, that was a typical payment for workers. Like, you would get 1 to 2 pounds of grain a day. She comes home, and she's got like this huge sack full of 30 to 50 pounds of grain.
I just yesterday, I bought a 30-pound bag of dog food. It was huge.
Yeah, it's massive. Yeah, that's a lot of grain. So anyway, yeah, like I said, we don't know for sure, but 30 pounds is a lot. And she took it, and she goes into the city, and her mother-in-law, so Naomi, saw what she had gleaned, and she took it out. She gave Naomi what she had left. And Naomi says to her, "Where did you glean today? And where did you work? May he who took notice of you be blessed." Because of course Naomi is shocked by all this too. I mean, that's the last thing she would have expected, for her to come home with that much food. So she responds, she says, the name of the man with whom I work today is Boaz. And Naomi says back to her, "May he be blessed of the Lord who has not withdrawn his kindness to the living and to the dead." And Naomi said to her, "The man is our relative. He is one of our," well, my translation has "closest relative." But the word that we're looking at here is the word that is most often associated with the book of Ruth. He's a goel. A goel is someone who engages in ga'al, and ga'al is a word for redeem. So he is one of our goelim. He's one of our redeemers. Now, I think we probably talked about this maybe back in Exodus or somewhere in the Torah, but there's a couple of different verbs for redeem in Hebrew. One is padah. For instance, when I think it's Exodus 13, when they're talking about redeeming the firstborn, that whole context of the 10th plague and the firstborn. Well, you redeem your firstborn. So, you know, if I have a son, and of course, I'm not going to offer him as a sacrifice, so I redeem him. I give something in exchange for him. So that is padah. That's that kind of redemption. There's another kind of redemption that is ga'al, and that is to redeem in the sense of buying back someone's property. If for some reason they've had to sell it because of impoverishment. We also encountered this particular verb when it talked about like a manslayer. You know, somebody kills my brother, and I'm the redeemer of blood, so I go after that person. So there's all kinds of responsibilities that are connected with redemption. And Naomi highlights then Boaz as one of the redeemers. He's the goel, who is hopefully, as the story progresses, hopefully he's going to be the one who engages in this redemption. And then just kind of finish out the chapter, Ruth goes on to say, oh, I forgot one thing. Furthermore, he said that I should stay close to his servants until they finish the harvest. So very good news. Not only does she bring home all of this food, not only do they find out that Boaz is one of the redeemers, but she's going to get to continue to go into his field and continue to glean. And Naomi says to her, "That's great. That is good, my daughter, that you go out with his maids, lest others fall upon you in another field." So lest others paga you, that is, you know, hurt you, assault you, come after you, something like that. It's a paga is often used for some kind of act of violence. So she doesn't, in other words, she knows that Ruth will be safe with the maidservants of Boaz.
Yes, I mean, it's a double good thing. I mean, so one, you come home with all this food, and then you say, yeah, he told me to keep coming back and not go somewhere else. So then you have good reason to think that you have a source of food that's not going to dry up real soon. So this is not going to be a one-time event, that this sort of good harvest of gleaning is going to continue. And then you have the safety aspect, that this is not going to be something that's dangerous for you to do. And in this way, with Boaz as a redeemer, I mean, if you're on the brink of starvation and someone has given you a way to have continual food, the process of redeeming you from this impoverished state has already begun, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's probably hard for us to imagine what it's like to be in a situation, at least most of me for sure. And you, and I mean, a lot of our listeners, I've never been like wondering, am I going to be able to eat tomorrow?
Yeah.
You know, but I know that, well, you told me about it, the show Alone, and Stacey and I have been watching, I think we're on, well, we're caught up with the current season, and there was one season we hadn't watched, so we're going back to watch it. When you watch a show like that, man, you realize just what it's like, at least as much as you can as an outsider, what it's like to go without food and to, you've seen this over and over, and it's not just like one person, but how like emotional they will get when they are able to actually catch a fish, mm-hmm. or find some food. I mean, like the emotion just overwhelms them. They're either rejoicing or they're crying because they might not have eaten for a day or a week. Or if they did, they didn't eat very much, and they catch a fish, and it's like, that is the most awesome thing that has ever happened to them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So just watching that happen in real life is drives home just how significant this is, to be able to not just have food at one time, but to know basically they got a grocery store. They can go out to the field every day and they'll be taken care of.
Yeah. I mean, part of this too, I mean, you think about it. I mean, if they're going to be coming home with anywhere near this much grain, even for a short amount of time, they ain't using 50 pounds of grain every day. I mean, so, I mean, at this point, you have enough food. You have something you can sell. I mean, obviously you can sell grain. So, I mean, you have more than you need. And so you're able to presumably take care of other needs by this vehicle.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, Boaz, in other words, is doing them not just the favor of watching out for them and giving them enough to eat, but he's basically providing a livelihood for both of them. Okay. Well, that's the end of, well, almost the end of chapter two. We have the last verse. So what happens? Well, obviously Ruth is going to stay close. She's going to stick to that field. So she stays with the maids of Boaz in order to glean until the end of the barley harvest and the wheat harvest. And she lived with her mother-in-law. And that's the way the chapter ends. So chapter three is, in my opinion, the most fascinating of the chapters. Just because of, there's all sorts of ambiguities here. If you've ever studied Ruth, you probably spent quite a bit of time in this chapter trying to figure out, okay, you know, what's happening here? You know, there's all sorts of subtleties, and some of the words that are used here can go a couple of different directions. And I think personally that it's designed that way, that there are gaps in the narrative, as it were, that you kind of have to fill in. So we'll have some fun with that when we go through this story, because this is when Ruth makes her move, if you will. This is when, you know, nothing has really happened. Of course, she's been around Boaz. We're not told whether he continued to talk to her. We're not told really anything else about the rest of the harvest. All we know is she continued to stay in the field of Boaz, and we're going to find out right away what Naomi wants to happen, and no doubt what Ruth wants to happen as well. But Boaz has not done anything to make this happen, and so the women are going to take the initiative, and we'll see the result. So beginning with chapter 3, verse 1, then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, shall I not seek security," or that could also be translated, "rest for you, that it may be well with you?" This is actually related to the same word that we saw in chapter 1 when Naomi's talking. This is when they're about to leave Moab to come back to Bethlehem. And Naomi's trying to get both of her daughters-in-law to return back to their mother's house. And she says, "May the Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband." So that's the idea. So back to chapter 3, she says, "Shall I?" So Naomi's kind of in the role of not mother-in-law, but mother here. In fact, she calls her my daughter. "Shall I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you?" So what she's talking about there is not just kind of a generic rest. She's talking about resting in the home of your husband. "Shall I not find the kind of peace and security and rest that you need, that it may be well with you?" And then she goes on to then lay out her plan as to how this is gonna work. "And now, is not Boaz our kinsman, with whose maids you were? Behold, tonight he winnows barley at the threshing floor. So here's what I want you to do. Wash yourself and anoint yourself." That could also be translated as perfume yourself. So wash yourself and then anoint or perfume yourself, and then put on your clothes. My translation has best clothes. I think that's an interpretive addition to the text. I don't know what ESV has there, but the word that's used there in Hebrew does not refer to your best clothes. It just refers to your outer garment. So when translations, I think maybe the NIV does that as well. Some translations will add like best clothes, but I mean, it was, but we can't really get that from the Hebrew. It's just a reference to your outer garment. So she's not telling her, in other words, like, you know, look through your closet and get the, you know, your best dress and put it on. She's just like, put on your garment. Now, yeah, one commentator,
the ESV just says to put on your cloak. Which could just mean it was cool outside.
Yeah, yeah. One commentator I was reading this morning had a pretty convincing argument that what might be communicated here is that up to this point, Ruth had been wearing the garb of a widow, which I thought was pretty fascinating. And he bases that on the fact that after the death of David's son that he had with Bathsheba, you know, before then, David, of course, when the child was sick before he died, David was, was weeping, was fasting, was praying. And then after the child dies, what does he do? He gets up, he washes himself, he anoints himself, and he puts on his cloak and he goes to the temple. So it's as if his mourning has ended. And so by paralleling that account of David with this, he makes the argument that maybe what was happening here was that up until this point, Ruth was wearing the garment of a widow. And maybe, possibly, that's why Boaz was not really making any moves, was just kind of, you know, taking care of her, but not suggesting marriage at that point. Whatever it is, anyway, that's what happens. She gets cleaned up, anoints herself, perfumes herself, puts on her cloak. And now Naomi says, not only that, but go down to the threshing floor, but don't make yourself known to the man until he's finished eating and drinking. And when he lies down, pay attention to where he lies. So note, literally just know, but pay attention to where he lies. And you shall go and uncover his feet and lie down. And then he will tell you what you shall do. Now, rather than pausing there, let me go ahead and just read what Ruth does. And she said to her, that is, Ruth said to Naomi, all that you say I will do. So I'm going to follow your instructions to the T. So verse 6, she went down to the threshing floor, like she was told, and she did all according to all that her mother-in-law had commanded her. When Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry, his heart was good, literally, then he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain, and she came secretly and uncovered his feet and lay down. And it happened in the middle of the night that the man was startled and bent forward, and behold, a woman was lying at his feet. And he said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your maid. So spread your covering over your maid, and for you are a redeemer." So just an amazing account here. This is you put yourself back in the situation. This was a pretty dangerous. We can certainly say it was a bold move on the part, not only of Naomi, but Ruth. I mean, both of them together. This was a very bold move. There are some people who, I'm going to get to the sexual innuendos in just a minute, but there are some people who reject those. They don't think there's any sexual innuendos here whatsoever in some of the language. Okay, we'll grant that, all right, just for the sake of argument, we'll grant that. Even if there are no sexual innuendos in the language, the very fact that a woman in this culture, a woman at night, is sneaking down to a threshing floor and then partially uncovering a man and lying next to him, that has all sorts of sexual innuendos, apart from the language question. So you got to grant that this is a very, very bold, dangerous, risque kind of move for Ruth to make.
If you are a guy who's not married and somebody came into wherever you sleep and lays down next to you, the idea that there's nothing sexual about that is a little absurd.
Yeah, it's extremely naive. Extremely naive.
In the middle of the night?
Yeah, yeah. Secretly?
Yeah. He had some to drink. That doesn't mean he was like blitz drunk or anything, but it means that he was feeling all right.
He was feeling good. Yeah.
Feeling good.
Yeah.
Exactly. Which is why, David says that God gave wine to make merry the hearts of men. There's a line there where you can, which you can certainly cross, but there's also, it's be feeling glad or happy or merry is that's right. That's like the sweet spot, according to the scriptures anyway. That's where you want to be.
Yeah. And it fits really the context. The scriptures more than once will use the joy of harvest or of threshing the grain as a symbol of happiness, right? Mm-hmm. So this was a joyful time because they had a harvest. There had been a famine in Bethlehem. Well, now there's a harvest, and so there's plenty of rejoicing. It's kind of a party atmosphere. They've been working hard, and so they have something to drink, and then they lie down right where they worked.
Yeah. So you ever been to a party morning and had random girl like lay down next to you in the middle of the night, and you're trying to tell me that there's nothing going on there?
Yeah, it's a stretch. And then to get to what I was alluding to earlier, there's definite, and anyone who reads this, who knows kind of the Hebrew background of some of this, will have to acknowledge that there's definite sexual allusions that's built into the language here. So to pick up with, let's see, verse 7, yeah. There's three verbs there, or three words there that can mean a couple of different things. So she goes to the threshing floor, Boaz eats and drinks, his heart is merry, he goes to sleep by the grain, and it says that Ruth came secretly and she uncovered his feet and lay down. So those three words in Hebrew for uncover and for feet and for lay down, all three of those can go a couple of different directions. And one of those directions is in the direction of either genitalia or sex. So the verb for uncover is galah. And galah is frequently used in contexts that have to do with sex or nakedness. So that's the one word to keep in mind. The second is feet. Now, sometimes raglayim. So one foot is regal, and then 2 feet is raglayim. Sometimes, yeah, that just refers to feet. But very frequently in the scriptures, that is a euphemism for your private parts, right? Then the verb for lay down, shakav, yeah, that can mean like, I'm gonna take a nap, I'm gonna shakav, I'm gonna lay down. But also, just like in English, you know, sometimes the word lay is used for laying down, sometimes it's used in a sexual sort of way. Same thing with shakav. So those three words like heaped right together in verse 7, she galahs, she uncovers. She uncovered his raglayim, that's feet, genitalia. And then she lays down right beside him. She shakavs. That those words with these very strong sexual nakedness, private parts connotations combined with the situation that we're in, it's pretty hard not to come away thinking, yeah, this is some very, very risky activity going on.
Yeah, it's hard not to come away with that, and it's easy to understand why, because this is what translators do, why they'd want to soften this up a little bit. Like, what's the purest and most pious way we can translate this?
Yeah, and don't think the translators don't do that, because I guarantee you, I'm writing this book right now for 1517, Unveiling Mercy, and it's daily devotional based on Hebrew words. So a lot of what I've done is, you know, I've looked at the various ways these Hebrew words are used in various contexts, and I'll look at the way translations will render them. And I have come across multiple times cases where, yeah, there'll be a word that literally means something which is a little bit provocative, and it will be softened down. I'd say the majority of times it's softened, it's kind of puritanized down to where it doesn't have quite that same at least connotation that it carries in the Hebrew. It doesn't sound like this to us in English, but she's using the Hebrew idiom that basically means marry me.
Yeah.
Make me your wife. If this same kind of language about spreading wings over someone, when a man spreads his wings or his covering over a woman, well, that means he's marrying her.
Yeah, it almost makes it sound like cover me with that blanket.
Yeah, cover me up. That's one of the strangest things about this whole book. So here you have a woman proposing to a man, a servant proposing to a man of wealth and standing, a foreigner proposing to an Israelite. I mean, this is so startling, the way that Ruth approaches this. So you got to give her credit. She's bold. She's creative. She's willing to risk basically everything in order to get what she wants. And I think most significantly, and we'll have to wrap up here, I think, most significantly is the way she ends, because she says, because you are a redeemer. So she's calling him to make a decision. She's like, that's who you are, right? So you ask me who I am. Well, I'm Ruth. Now, who are you, Boaz? Yeah, who are you going to be? Are you going to do what a redeemer does, or are you not?
This redemption sort of got started with, you know, dropping some extra grain along the way. But yeah, you're asking, so are we going to do this redemption or not?
Yeah, right. The moment of truth. And I guess, you know, people just got to wait till next time.
Yeah,
we'll have to figure out what his answer is.
Yeah, see how Boaz responds. I mean, it's a bold move. He certainly could respond negatively to this entire proposal.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we have the story in front of us, but like if you were in that situation, he could have said like, get out of here, right? Or no, or even worse. So I guess we'll see what his response was.
All right. Well, guys, if you enjoyed the podcast, go over to iTunes, rate and review. We'd appreciate it. Go check out the YouTube channel. Check out the social media. And we will be back next week.